Well, I believe the brethren were blessed yesterday with Brother Stein's service. And so today we've got another lesson for us. It's called Just Before Armageddon. Just Before Armageddon.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Everybody bright-eyed and bushy-tailed this morning? I don't know about the bushy tail, but I'll go for the bright eye. We have a lot of experiences. When I say we, I'm speaking about the Spirit-begotten church collectively. Between now and the finishing of the course of that church. Individually, we don't know what will be the experiences we will have, but collectively, we do. And we'd like to talk a little bit about that in our lesson this morning. What are the experiences to be expected collectively by the church before Armageddon? And you might say, well, Brother Stein, how are you going to get that? Well, we're going to look at a lot of pictures, a lot of parallels that we find in Scripture in the experiences of God's servants at other times in history. And we're going to try to draw from those experiences what we might expect. Now, from one standpoint, you might say, oh no, this is a gloom and doom talk. Well, you could argue that. But remember when, I think it was Ananias, was sent to the Apostle Paul, he was told, I want you to tell him what great things he must suffer on my behalf. So gloom and doom to the flesh? Yeah, we're going to die. You consecrated to that, so no surprise there. But it will be to the glory of God. And when we see some of the circumstances in which some of us may be expected to find ourselves, I think it will be faith strengthening when we are in those circumstances. We'll say, oh, I know what this is. I know this is the end of my walk. I know what I have to do. So that's what we seek today. I'm going to start with a question from the question book. This is from question book page 617. This question was asked of Brother Russell in 1915. Will all of the saints be taken beyond the veil before the time of trouble is over? And here's what Brother Russell wrote. I am not wise enough to answer. I think no one is. We had thought so. We had supposed that all the saints would be beyond the veil before the times of the Gentiles ended. God did not say they would be. But we inferred so. And you know, our inferences may prove wrong. And in this case, did prove wrong. We were not taken. The times of the Gentiles have ended, and we are still here. So we do not know just when our time will come. To say that we will be taken before the time of trouble is ended would be to say what I believe. There is one thing I think that we all agree upon. That we believe we will all be taken before the Armageddon feature. You know, the Bible gives us the symbols of loosing of the winds, which is this great war. Then comes the earthquake, which is the great revolution to follow. Then comes the fire, the anarchy, Armageddon experiences. I think the church, the bride class, will be gone before that Armageddon experience, but cannot be sure. We will leave the subject there. I have always appreciated Brother Russell's humility. He told you what was right, what was clear, what was provable, what was a thus saith the Lord, and he let you know, this is how I view it. It could be different, though. But Brother Russell did think that the church would be complete and glorified before the Armageddon outbreak. So that also means that the final experiences of the church will occur and finish as Armageddon starts. As I mentioned, our lesson this morning is going to review a number of these. I think there's an expression, to be forewarned is to be forearmed. And as I mentioned earlier, any of us that have the privilege of living into those experiences, when you find yourself in the experience, you will know what it is, you will know what you have to do, and you know what it will mean. Death of the flesh and that wonderful glory beyond. Let's start with the final experiences of Jesus. Now, we're not going to say that these experiences are typical, necessarily, but what we want to see is that we think there'll be some parallels. Experience number one. By the way, the way that we're going to do this is we're going to look at the experience, and then we're going to make application, our experience. Betrayal. You know the experience of Jesus here. One of his close confidants, one of his 12 apostles, betrayed him, Judas. You know, it's interesting, there's a type of this in the Old Testament. King David was betrayed once. You can find this in 1 Samuel 15. You may remember that he had a counselor that had been with him a very long time, a man by the name of Ahithophel. Say that three times. And somewhere in this long experience that Ahithophel had with David, Ahithophel was an older man. He wasn't a younger man in David's age category. And he had been a faithful counselor. His counsel was very highly sought after. And appreciated. But at some point, something changed. And Ahithophel betrayed David to one of his sons. By the way, I remember having a discussion many years ago about this. Why did this happen? What made a man change like this? I think you'll understand it Very quickly, when I mentioned to you that Ahithophel was Bathsheba's grandfather, you see a motive? Yeah, he had been a faithful counselor, but he was so enraged, we surmise, by what David did to Bathsheba and the killing of Uriah, he said, I'm going to get back at this guy. Now, that was bad thinking, because whatever David did, he was still the Lord's anointed. And so he got back at the Lord's anointed, and it didn't end well for him. Anyone remember what was the final act of Judas? What did he do? He hung himself. Guess what the final act of Ahithophel was? He hung himself. There's a picture there. So Jesus had this experience. Brethren, our experience. It's hard to believe, but some of us will find that we are betrayed by our brethren. How's it come about? How does one with whom we've had fellowship and love, we've broken bread, we've shared meals, how can one betray us? Well, consider the situation which we guess or the surmise will be going at the time just before Armageddon. Meetings may be forbidden. You can't get together. Distribution of truth literature will be against the law. Giving any kind of truth message will be illegal. Now, by the way, just think about the development and evolution of the laws in this country right now. If in a public place you said something publicly against homosexuals, what could you be charged with? A hate crime! It's already illegal to say certain things. So in a crisis, it shouldn't surprise us that the powers that be, especially if they're linked up with religious powers, which we expect, and we'll talk a little bit more, will now make certain types of speech illegal. Betrayal will come from within. Psalm 41:9. Yea, my own familiar friend in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, hath lifted up his heel against me. That was David writing. He was writing about Ahithophel. But it was typical of Jesus in his experience with Judas, and it can be applied to us. Brethren, first of all, it shouldn't make us suspicious of one another. Knowing that there will be betrayers that arise from within us shouldn't get us to the point where we're looking, hey, well, who's it going to be? Well, he said, she said something. Oh, no, don't do that. Remember, this is all in God's hands. When you are betrayed, if you are betrayed, it's because the Lord permitted it. Let the Lord handle the punishment. Let the Lord handle the matters. You just stay faithful and continue, as we learned yesterday, love your brethren intensely. Be willing to lay your life down for them. Jesus laid his life down for Judas, didn't he? In fact, I don't know if you ever thought about it, but in looking at that betrayal scene, it struck me one day when I was studying this. Here's Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Here comes up a group of soldiers and priests. And who's in the lead? Judas. And then one of the soldiers comes upon the group of Jesus and the disciples. Jesus stands up, says, who are you looking for? We're looking for Jesus, Nazareth. I am he. Why did Jesus do that? Jesus knew he was going to be betrayed. He knew it from the prophecies. He expected it. I would suggest, my opinion, Jesus was giving Judas an opportunity not to do it. You don't need to be betrayed when somebody reveals it. By the way, when you said, I am he, remember it says they were knocked down by it. There was something powerful about this. He asked him again, who are you? It's me. Judas could have stopped right there. He didn't have to say another word. But what did he do? He went up and he gave him the kiss of betrayal. I only point this out because Jesus still was trying to help Judas. Jesus still had a love for his 12 apostles, trying to make that act of betrayal unnecessary. It was unnecessary. But we see clearly that awfulness in the heart of Judas to do that dastardly deed. He went through with it anyway. Another experience of Jesus. We'll read some scriptures here. Matthew 25:59-62. Now the chief priests and the elders and all the council sought false witnesses against Jesus to put him to death. This is at the point where he had already been arrested, and now these folks are looking for false witnesses. Verse 60, but found none. Yea, though many false witnesses came, yet found they none. At last came two false witnesses and said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. The high priest arose and said unto him, answerest thou nothing what it is which these witnesses testify against thee? So Jesus is being, as the expression goes, shanghaied here. This was a false trial. They're looking for witnesses. In fact, I don't know if you ever thought of the irony of it. These guys, they want to murder Jesus. We're going to talk a little bit more about that murder in a moment. That was what they wanted to do. They wanted to murder him. And they're gathering all these false witnesses to get together. But the law says only by the mouth of two or more. So we got to follow the law. We need two witnesses. Isn't that strange? Murder on one side, and yet, we got to follow the law on the other. In Luke 22:54, after this inquisition, it says, then they took him and led him and brought him to the high priest's house, and Peter followed afar off. Remember when all this took place? Was it in a nice afternoon in a public place where everybody could see it? No. It was in the middle of the night. It was in the high priest's house where only a few could see it. A midnight judicial hearing at the high priest's house. Many of the witnesses came. They found two.
And notice that they use something that Jesus said and twisted it. You know, many falsehoods are made from twisting a little bit of truth.
They did it.
Our experience, the experience of the church, when we get up to the nearness of Armageddon, when there are laws and persecution against us preaching the truth and practicing the truth, we can expect trials in the middle of the night. We can expect false witnesses to speak out against us. And just like in Jesus' time, they will take things that you said and twist it. Remember, our enemies are always looking for something against us, and that will be the time when it will come to its fruition. By the way, what did Jesus say during all of this?
Nothing.
He kept his mouth shut. I remember Brother Russell noticed one, made a point I read years ago. I don't have the citation for you, but he said that Jesus was so expert in handling speech, he could well have delivered himself just with his speech,
but he kept quiet.
That should be what we do too. Just keep quiet, let things go. We mentioned they were murder. This is the next experience, the rationalization of murder. John 11:49-50. And one of them, named Caiaphas, being a high priest that same year, said unto them, "You know nothing at all. Neither consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, that the whole nation perish not." It's also recorded in John 18:14.
Said it a second time.
Think of the callousness here. You know, we as a nation of Israel, Caiaphas says, we got a problem and this guy's causing a problem. You know, it's a good thing. It's expedient that we kill him so that all of us live. Now, it's interesting that Holy Spirit probably overruled here a little bit, because what Caiaphas was saying was, in one respect, true. It's expedient that the whole human race live, that Jesus die. But that wasn't his motive. He had a murderous motive, with no sympathy, no compassion at all, no appreciation of the preciousness of human life. Our experience, brethren, it may be murder, it may be other things, but legal action against us will be couched in the explanation of, well, it's for the common good. We can't have you talking about this or that because you're causing too much problem. We have to shut you down for the common good. The next experience, Jesus on the cross, Luke chapter 23, verses 39 and 43. You know, in most of these experiences, you are familiar with, brethren, so we're going through them quickly, just getting the salient details and making application. Luke 23:39. One of the malefactors which were hanged, railed on him, saying, "If thou be Christ, save thyself and us." But the other rebuking him, saying, "Dost thou not fear God, seeing that thou art in the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive due rewards for our deeds. But this man hath done nothing amiss." Here was an informed malefactor, wasn't he? And he said to Jesus, "Lord, remember me when thou comest to thy kingdom." And Jesus said unto him, "Verily I say unto thee, today shalt thou be with me in paradise." And you know, we'll put the comma. I'm saying you today, thou shalt be with me in paradise. You know that. There were these two traditionally crucified people with Jesus. One was a believer and mocked him. One was not and asked to be remembered. In our experience, brethren, when the crackdown comes upon free speech and free religious speech, it will not only be Bible students that are afflicted, it will be many other groups. When we look at the two on the cross with Jesus, we think that this might parallel two other groups, or at least two other collective groups. One was not a believer. When a crackdown comes on free speech, you can be sure that libertarians, other political, rational groups will say, this is not right, and they will be with us in the persecution. And you can also be sure that there are other believers, not of the Bible students, that are going to be affected as well. And they will look, perhaps, to us as those did to Jesus for some hope. So don't think for a moment that it's just Bible students, it's just the consecrated church. There's no doubt that's the focus of Satan, but we will be, I would suspect and I surmise, in the company of others. For our next one, we're going to go back to the Old Testament in 1 Kings chapter 22. The prophecy of Micaiah. Let me give the background here. There had been war going on for 3 years between Israel and Syria. And when I say Israel, I'm talking about the northern 10-tribe kingdom of Israel. King at that time was a fellow by the name of Ahab, for you recognize that name. So the war evidently hadn't been going so well. So Ahab says to King Jehoshaphat of the 2-tribe kingdom of Judah and Benjamin, he says that Ramoth in Gilead, which is our territory, is now being in the hands of the king of Syria. We can't permit that to happen. We should do something about it. So Jehoshaphat, being more of a careful guy, he says, all right. He says, well, you know, maybe we should see what God has to say about this. And King Ahab says, good idea. Hey, prophets of Baal, you 400, come over here. What do you think? Should we go to war against the king of Syria?
God,
going to war, all 400. It's unanimous. But Jehoshaphat is not quite so convinced. He says, you don't have a prophet of Jehovah here. You got a prophet of Jehovah, maybe you'd like to hear from him. Well, let's pick up the narrative. This is 1 Kings 22. I want to start reading in verse 8. And the king of Israel, this is Ahab, said to Jehoshaphat, well, there is one man, Micaiah, the son of Amiah, by whom we may inquire of the Lord. But I hate him. That's an interesting comment. Evidently, Ahab has a little history with Micaiah, doesn't he? Doesn't sound like it's a good history. He says, for he doth not prophesy good concerning me, but evil. Gee, what a surprise, right? And Jehoshaphat said, let not the king say so. The king of Israel called an officer and said, hasten hither, Micaiah, the son of Amiah. And the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, each sat on the throne, having put on robes, in a void place at the entrance of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets before them. Let's pause here. I want you to get this picture now. Right? They called for the prophet of Jehovah, Micaiah, and they prepared. So here's the two kings, it says, in their robes. Oh, these guys are regal. They're splendidly. And over here is the whole host of Israel. Over here is the 400 prophets of Baal. So they're waiting for Micaiah to be delivered unto them. That's the scene here. And Zedekiah, the son of Chenaiah, made him horns of iron. Thus saith the Lord. By the way, before, this is one of the false prophets of Baal here, this Zedekiah. Thus saith Jehovah. Amusing. With these shalt thou push the Syrians until thou have consumed them. Now picture this. He's got these horns, right? And he's saying, here, this is what we're going to do. We're going to push Syria right out. By the way, for those of you who like prophecy, two-horned beast? Interesting, isn't it? Verse 12, and all the prophets prophesy, saying, go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into thy hand. Verse 13, and the messenger that was gone to call Micaiah spoke unto him, saying, behold now, the words of the prophet declare good things unto the king with one mouth. Let thy word, I pray thee, be like the word of one of them, and speak thou which is good. You get what he's saying here? All right, Micaiah, we're going back here. By the way, everybody said this. You'd be well to say the same thing. It's kind of encouraging here that not to rattle the boat. Verse 14, and Micaiah said, as Jehovah liveth, what Jehovah saith unto me, that will I speak. So he came unto the king, and the king said, Micaiah, shall we go against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall we forbear? There's the question. Now, scripture here says, and he answered him, go, prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into the hand of the king. Now, is Micaiah being sarcastic here? The answer is yes, because you see what he said, what Ahab says in the next verse? The king said to him, how many times shall I adjure thee to tell thee nothing but that which is true in the name of the Lord? I mean, I can picture this, right? The king's saying, shall we go and not? Yeah, go prosper. It's going to be great for you. You're going to have a wonderful time. You're going to party. Everything's fine. You see the sarcasm? Ahab picked up on that. He said, you can't do that. You just tell me the truth. So Micaiah gives him the truth. Verse 17. A little bit of a parable here. And he said, and I saw all Israel upon the hills as sheep that have not a shepherd. And Jehovah said, these have no master. Let them return every man to his house in peace. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, didn't I tell you that he would prophesy no good concerning me but evil? Let's interpret here what he said. You know what I see? I see your whole army scattered. Your general, your corporals, your divisions, all broken, and everybody's just going back to their own house. That was the picture. And so Ahab says, didn't I tell you he's going to say bad things about me? Verse 19. And he said, and this is Micaiah speaking now, hear thou therefore the word of Jehovah. I saw Jehovah sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing by him, on the right hand and on the left. And Jehovah said, who shall persuade Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said on one matter, and another said on the other matter. There came forth a spirit and stood before Jehovah and said, I will persuade him. And the Lord said unto him, wherewith? And he says, I will go forth, and I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And he said, thou shalt persuade him, and prevail also. Go forth, and do so. Now therefore, behold, the Lord hath put a lying spirit in the mouth of these of prophets, and the Lord hath spoken evil concerning thee. So there it was. You notice here there's an incrimination of all those 400 prophets. By the way, Ahab, you know what they told you? It's a lie. And that a lying spirit was there to convince you to go. You've got to take some courage on the part of Micaiah before the kings to say these things. Verse 24. But Zedekiah, here's that false prophet again with the two horns, the son of Chenaniah, went near and smote Micaiah on the cheek and said, which way went the Spirit of the Lord from me to speak unto thee? He just slapped him and then made the sarcastic comment. And Micaiah said, behold, Thou shalt see that day, when thou shalt go near to an inner chamber to hide thyself. And the king of Israel said, take Micaiah and carry him back unto Ammon, the governor of the city, and to Joash, the king's son, and say, thus saith the king, put this fellow in prison. Feed him with the bread of affliction and with the water of affliction until I come in peace. And Micaiah said, if thou return in peace, the Lord hath not spoken by me. And he said, hearken, O people, every one of you. Because if you come in peace, the Lord wasn't talking by me. Very honest statement. Well, we could read a little bit more, but let me kind of sum this up. How'd that war with the king of Syria go? How'd that work out? Not well. Jehoshaphat gets wounded. In fact, if you read it a little bit more, I don't know, Jehoshaphat may have been a little bit dim as a king, because when they got out to the battlefield, Ahab says, you know, he says, yeah, King of Syria has been fighting me for a while. You know, he kind of knows who I am. Why don't you put the beautiful robes of regal on? You know, I'll just stand over here. Talk about making somebody a target. Well, the battle didn't go well. In this picture, we see the king's advisors tell them what they want to hear. And you know that there's a union here, a cooperation between civil and religious authorities. You have the prophets of Baal. And then you have the kings, in this case the two kings, the king of Judah, king of Israel, all conspiring together to do something. But the true prophet has an opportunity. Except for a little sarcasm, he tells them that what they're going to do is going to be a disaster. And what happens? He gets thrown into prison for his message with bread and water. Our experience, brethren, the rulers will seek the advice of religious partners in an ecumenical spirit and hear what they want to hear to maintain their power. But the true church will speak out in loyalty to God. Results will be imprisonment. We already mentioned, you know, that there's this little clue in here about the two-horned beast. You might want to consider for your further study winding that together. All right, now we're going to go on to another Old Testament experience, one you know well, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego. By the way, it's kind of sad that this is the names we remember them by, because that's the Babylonian names. What were their Hebrew names? Were Azariah, Hananiah, and Mishael. Right? There's their real names. Well, you know the picture. Nebuchadnezzar sets up this image on the plain of Dura. Interesting, it's given its dimensions. Again, it was 60 cubits high and 6 cubits in breadth. You got a 6-6 there. That's significant. You think about the 666 in Revelation, which is the papal image. Now you have something which is evidently a Protestant image. We'll get to that. He arranges this huge dedication ceremony. He gathers together all the counselors of the land, the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, etc., etc. And in Daniel 3, verse 5, he says, to you it is commanded, O people, nations, and language, that at the time you hear the sound of the cornet, the flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, that ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. And whoso falleth not down and worship this in this, the same hour shall be cast in the midst of the fiery furnace. So you have kind of an ecumenism here. Well, you know what happened? Certain of the Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They said, you know, there's some people that are not doing this. And they singled out Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were brought before the king. He says, is it true that you're not going to do it? And they said, oh, king, yes, that's true. Don't you know you can be killed? Yeah. If that's what our God wants us to do, then that's what will happen. If he can deliver us, he will. But we're still going to do what God told us to do, and that's not to practice idolatry. We will not serve your gods, period. Well, Nebuchadnezzar, full of fury, heats up the fiery furnace. It says 7 times. You know, I guess you can't take that in the physics sense, because that would be a lot harder they can get it. But I would say that they threw 7 times as much fuel in there or blew 7 times as much air, however. And in fact, it was so bad that the guys that threw them in didn't survive. So in they go, down they go, and Nebuchadnezzar looks in and he sees not only are they not dead, but they're walking around in there, and what's this? There's somebody else in there with them. Must have been a scene. What do you think Nebuchadnezzar was thinking? What is this? And then they come out. And I like a little detail. It says that even the smell of the fire wasn't on them. You talk about our Heavenly Father Jehovah handling details, right? It wasn't even the smell of the fire. You know, most of us, you know, walk behind a fire in the yard or something, and you get that smell in your hair so easily. Well, he changed his mind on these things, and in verse 28, he says, Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies that they might not serve or worship any god except their own. Therefore I make a decree to every people, nation, and language that speak out anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other god that can deliver after this sort. And then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego
in the province of Babylon.
This is quite a change, isn't it? And how relieved Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego had
must have been.
Well, let's translate that to our experience. What does it suggest about our experiences? Nebuchadnezzar here was not only the king, but he was the religious chief. And I surmise that one of the reasons why he got this image up is that he had a lot of different governments and kingdoms that he had conquered. So he had a lot of different religious thinking. You know, maybe there was some conflict. We don't know that, but there was different gods that the Egyptians would serve and the Phoenicians and so forth and so on. So by saying, well, we're going to serve one God and it's going to be this image. This is in ecumenism, isn't it? We're going to bring all together under one religious heading. Brother Russell in the fourth volume, page 581, wrote this. In harmony with this, we find in Revelation 13 a prophecy of a special combination of influence by which Protestant denominations will be unified and, though separate, be brought into cooperation with papacy in a manner that will give both increased powers, deceive many into supposing that the new combination will be God's instrumentality for doing the work predicted by Messiah, and thus it is his representative. We're applying this to our time, to a time when religious and civil authorities come to cooperate together and the two great religious bodies, Protestant and Catholicism, come together. Here's another point on this, reprint 2495. As already pointed out, the beast represents not Roman Catholics, the people, but the Roman Catholic system as an institution. And the image represents not Protestants, the people, but the consolidation of Protestant systems as an institution. And the Roman Catholic Church is an idol, as are the Greek Catholic, Anglican, Lutheran, Methodist, Presbyterian, all similarly demanding worship, obedience, and revenue. The first step in formation of the symbolic image of the papacy was the Evangelical Alliance, going back before Brother Russell, 1846. This was replaced with an updated version, the World Council of Churches, in the 20th century. We surmise that the king in the image, representing a uniting of civil and religious power that demand recognition and obedience, i.e. worship. The results of this? If this happens, as we surmise, as we think it could, again, more persecution. Now, you'll find that we're getting into the talk here now where I'm going to be a little bit repetitive, but the repetition is to show you that the conclusions and illustrations that we used earlier are, in fact, repeated multiple times. Our neighbors might report us, like Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, brought in for questioning as they were, maybe even be given an opportunity to change our position. You remember our dear brethren in the first century got brought in before Caesar and said, you know, just a little tiny pinch of incense, just throw it that way, we'll let you out. And they didn't do that. So, brethren, there will be opportunities for compromise for the church at the very end of the age. Those that are convicted of disloyalty will be bound and imprisoned, perhaps executed as well. By the way, you know those that through Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego were consumed by their own fire? This sort of suggests there may be some immediate consequences for those that murdered the saints. You know, sort of a little witness. This is at the time of Jesus. You remember how it got dark and whatnot? People say, maybe putting this Jesus fell on the cross wasn't a very good idea. It sort of suggests there may be some things by that. By the way, I quoted reprint 2445. There's more in that reprint that you may find interesting. What time do I go to, Brother Mark? I kind of lost track of the time. 10:30. Oh, okay. My goodness. This is two in a row. I'm ahead of myself here. Maybe we'll open it up for some questions because it looks like I'm going to finish a little bit early. Daniel chapter 5. Here's another example. Daniel before Belshazzar. Again, we won't read the account, but we'll just sketch it very quickly. This is the night before Babylon fell. And you may remember, what were the Babylonians doing? They were having a big party, weren't they? And during the party, somebody had the great idea. Hey, let's bring out the holy vessels from Solomon's temple. So they did that. And while they were all hooping it up and having a great time, you remember the disembodied hand? Meeny, meeny, tikkun olam. This is the scene we're talking about. Well, this scared the wits out of everybody, and the queen recommends they bring in Daniel. Daniel's still around at this time. What a long life of faithful service he had. And the king offers gifts to Daniel. I'll give you this, that, you know, and the other thing if you interpret the message. Daniel says, keep your gifts, I'll interpret the warning. He gives the judgment message and interprets the writing. They should have been more scared, but I guess they took some solace. At least they know what it meant, and the party's still not exhausted yet. So they change his garments. This is interesting. They give him scarlet garments with a chain of gold. Of course, as you know, that night the king is slain and Babylon falls. Our experience. The great feast before the destruction of Babylon seems to correspond well with the great denominational union expected soon. That's a quote from the pastor. We'll look at that in a moment. The abused temple vessels seem to represent the truths of the Lord's consecrated people.
golden vessels, perhaps the little flock, silver vessels, the great company. Daniel certainly represents the little flock in this picture. The church will be completed before the final destruction of Babylon. An important point that comes out of this, one that we generally recognize from other things, but we will not be on this side of the veil when the final destruction of Babylon occurs. Daniel's given a scarlet robe. We know that scarlet represents sacrificial death. So here we have maybe a little indicator that the little flock would finish their course. And the golden chains would represent the faithfulness, their faithfulness and the reward of the divine nature that they have. There might be more in this. You know, we've looked at this a couple times, and I don't think we've exhausted what this picture seems to show. Here's a reprint, 2487. A little lengthy, but let me read it. The great feast, which preceded the fall of Babylon, would seem to correspond well with a great denominational union expected soon, and the season of rejoicing which will accompany it. The gold and silver vessels of the Lord's house, which were profane, may fitly represent not only the precious truths of the divine revelation, but also the Lord's consecrated people. The golden vessels representing the little flock, and the more numerous silver vessels representing the great company. What may be the character of the defilement and injury of these is, of course, problematical. But in any case, we can remember that those consecrated vessels were all highly honored and restored to the temple by Cyrus. And likewise, we know not only the truths of divine revelation will all be cared for by the Lord, but also that all of these are His, and they shall be glorified in the spiritual temple which He would rear shortly. So again, we have another picture here of civil and denominational, at least civil and religious power coming together and affecting. Now, it's interesting. Each of these pictures gives just a little bit of a glint. The differences are very helpful in seeing into the details here. You know, if the Lord gave us one picture, we wouldn't have a full picture, because one picture can't show the whole picture. It can't show everything. So we have multiple pictures here. 2 Kings 2, Elijah. You're very familiar with this, the last day of Elijah. It's interesting that there seemed to be a general knowledge among Elijah's contemporaries at that time, when contemporaries, I mean the Elisha and the sons of the prophets, they seem to know that this was the end coming up. So Elijah and Elisha start out from the city of Gilgal. They travel to Bethel. They travel to Jericho. Then they cross the Jordan. And then Elijah is taken up into heaven by a whirlwind. Verse 11 there, and this is the 2 Kings 2. And it came to pass, as they still went on and talked, that behold, there appeared as a chariot of fire and horses of fire, and parted them both asunder, and Elisha went up by a whirlwind into heaven. There's three elements in this verse. There's the chariot of fire. We might see this as the victory that Elijah had. And for the class, he represents a spiritual victory, exaltation, as a result of enduring faithfully the fiery trials. There's horses of fire. You remember what horses generally represent? Doctrines, yeah. There's horses of fire, doctrines of truth that we faithfully stand for that also lead to fiery trials. Please note that your trials come about because you are faithfully standing for the truth. If you don't faithfully stand for the truth, you'll avoid the trials, but you'll also miss out on some other things. Whirlwind, beginning of the final phases of the time and trouble, Armageddon. Some have suggested the four winds here coming together, forming this whirlwind. There's some other thoughts here as well. I'd like to quote the second volume, page 260, regarding this. Elijah was separated from earthly scenes by a chariot of fire, representative of the spiritual glory and exaltation waiting at the end of the earthly race course, those of the church alive and remaining to the last days. But we should also remember that it was by a whirlwind of storm that he was taken away, and a storm is a symbol of trouble, as much as the fiery chariot is a figure of victory and glorious escape from that trouble. Well, let's focus a little bit more on our experiences there. We know the fate of our flesh in the immediate years of the future. How long that's going to be, we don't know. I'm sure that many of us will end our course relatively peaceful, dying of old age or whatever. But remember, we're focusing on that group of the church that is going to remain to the very end. And it may not be any of us here, or the majority of us here, or a minority of us here, but there will be some that will go through these experiences. We must not slacken our preaching work. You remember yesterday, one of the things I was looking for when I listened to the other three brethren and myself were points of commonality. Several times you heard the importance of preaching the word. Did you pick that up? It was a repetitive lesson from several of the brethren. And when you've got a repetitive lesson, what's the Lord trying to do? Say, hey, this is important. Our end will come, at least the church's end will come in a fiery trial. It will involve doctrines of truth, the horses, and it will come when the winds are let loose in the whirlwind. Let's jump back to the New Testament now and talk about John the Baptist a little bit. Jesus said in John 3:30, he must increase, that I must, or John said of Jesus, He must increase, but I must decrease. You know, we've used that to recognize that the gradual shrinking of the Bible student movement. You know, I've been in the truth since 1975, many of you many years earlier. But you know how big a movement was, relatively speaking, the Bible student movement in Brother Russell's time, and the influence that it had. It was a very influential movement. It was a very public movement. Remember all the newspapers, like 1,400 newspapers that Brother Russell had a column in every week. The Photodrama of Creation was just this was a very large movement, to be sure. Today, the movement has gotten very small. But one of the things that kind of tickles me is that the influence of the Bible student movement on the Internet is far and away larger than our numbers. You ever notice that? I heard some comments from those that on the other side that are opposing the Bible student movement. They get the idea that there's huge numbers of people. Well, there isn't. But the Lord is prospering your efforts, prospering the efforts of the brethren to get the word out publicly. John announced the presence of Messiah. Behold, the Lamb of God. We announce the presence of Messiah. He announced that the work of the Lord would be to judge the world and save the world. Our preaching is about the judgment of Jesus and the saving of Jesus. John reproved the adulterous relationship between Herod and Herodias. We don't see fully the adulterous relationship between the governments and the church today. Certainly, you go back 100 years ago in Brother Russell's time, it was much more controlling on each side. But as you've seen from many of the other pictures that we've looked at, it is something that we are still expecting. And when it happens, there's no doubt that those that see it and understand it will speak up about it. Herod wanted to put John to death, but he feared the reaction of the people who counted him as a prophet. It sort of suggests that the preaching that we do with respect to the adulterous relationship between the civil and religious authorities, the cooperation there, may in fact be recognized by others that would give us some measure of time to get the message out before the end comes. John was imprisoned. Herodias wanted him dead. She launched a plot using her daughter. Herod falls for it, is tricked. Jesus is beheaded. His head is brought before Salome. Herod represents civil government, Herodias, religious authority, their marriage, church-state union, prison, restriction of our opportunities, the full end of the harvest work, beheading, the sacrificial death. The head to Herodias, that short-term feeling on the part of religious authorities. Brother, I want to conclude, and I think if Brother Mark is okay, I will open it up for some questions afterwards since we're ahead of schedule. But I want to conclude by reading to you from the second volume, page 264. First, we should be so prepared, so armed, and so thoroughly furnished with the invincible truth that persecution would move us only to greater zeal and not lead us through surprise or fear to lower our standard, nor to surrender when the kings of the earth stand up and with the religious rulers of the people are gathered against us and against the truths to which God has granted us the privilege of witnessing as his servants and ambassadors. Second, such reflections relative to the future, contrasted with the privileges of the present, should serve to stimulate every consecrated child of God to make diligent use of the present grand harvest opportunities and privileges. Remembering that he that reapeth receiveth wages, as truly as he that planted and watered, and that now is preeminently the time of gathering fruit into eternal life. The little quiet of the present favorable time, with its greater liberties and advantages in every way, is divinely arranged in order to the sealing of the true servants of God in their foreheads, intellectually with the truth. So what's the bottom line? Is there's trouble for the church ahead, but we're not there yet. There's great opportunities to let your voice be heard. Let your diligence in serving God and preaching the truth and serving one another make use of the time that we have. I would be happy to entertain some questions. And by the way, I have to apologize. You know, I have all my scriptures here. I don't even have a Bible up here. So I might be going on my memory here a little bit. Yes, Brother Joseph. Yeah, that's what we're suggesting. That the Gentile times ended a certain relationship that they had. This idea of divine right of kings, which was so prevalent back in Brother Russell's day, that's gone. That's gone completely. You don't have any of the kings that exercise any real authority or power, with maybe a couple of exceptions. Most of Western Europe is gone. But the idea here is that there is some type of cooperation at the very end. Now, the degree of that it's been a little bit discussed. You know, we used to use the term church-state union. And some of the brethren objected to that because they can't see them coming together again like they did before. But you'll notice in several of the quotes I made from Brother Russell, he used the word cooperation. And that's the type of thing that we see. About 2 years ago, I'm going to go back to my talk yesterday. Remember I put up there the Kenneth Copeland Ministries? Remember Kenneth Copeland there? Bill Gill came across a video which was stunning. You can find this on the internet if you look it. I downloaded it. I've got the video myself, and if anybody can't find it, just ask me. Probably Brother Gill probably has the link as well. But what Kenneth Copeland did, he arranged a big assembly or convention of religious leaders from across Christendom. There were people there from the charismatic movement, from the churches and whatnot, and I don't know how many were there, but I'm going to say thousands. It was a very large gathering. And he had as a guest speaker a young clergyman. I just remember his first name, Tony, who was killed in a motorcycle accident not too long after that. But this guy was one of the best speakers I ever heard in my life. And his message was ecumenical. And his message says, we have to recognize that the Catholic Church is the Mother Church. We've come from that. You know, and we need to recognize our roots. And he was very compelling. I mean, you listen to this guy, wonderful, wonderful speaker. And then when he was done, Kenneth Copeland got up and he says, you know, this is the purpose of us getting together to talk about what we can do to cooperate and come together a little bit more and not pick at each other and whatnot. He says, and I have a special message now that was videotaped that I want to play for everyone here. And this is intended for you. And he starts this video, and it's Pope Francis. That was stunning to me. I mean, because this was primarily charismatic leaders in the evangelical movement. Pope Francis giving this message, this ecumenical message. Well, that was 2 years ago. And to me, that is one of the unexpectedly early indicators of this cooperation that we can expect a little bit later. And remember that, what's the motivation? Why would these people want to get together at all? The answer is, they see crisis. They see demise. They see disintegration. And they want to retain their power, their authority, political as well as religious. And in order to do that, they will come together. Remember the pictures about the islands falling into the mix of the sea and the earthquake and whatnot? You see the rise of populism all over the earth today. And the powers that be, this is worrying them a little bit. And no doubt, they're calculating and figuring out, well, how can we retain our power structure? How can we keep this status quo that's so comfortable to us, you know, as this populism rising? And of course, the chaos and anarchy that's coming from Islamic groups that are radical—that's another concern as well. Anyway, to answer your question, Joseph, is yes, this is distinct from the lockstep that the churches and government used to have in past centuries. This is a cooperation for purposes of self-preservation. Good question. Brother Ed, please.
Ohio put an amendment on a Defense of Marriage Act, mm-hmm. and all the evangelicals came out of the woodwork, and Ohio had a record number of people voting because of that. And it won Ohio, which put him in the White House.
Good observation.
And my question is, though, I've got on the websites of the Evangelical Alliance, Focus on the Family, the Catholic website for Unity of the Faith. You do not find, at least I've not been able to find, you know, saying, oh, we're cooperating with this Protestant branch or this Catholic branch. So it's difficult to find or even see in the news or even grasp, you know, get a grip on how deep or how outside of the political realm mm-hmm. of how deep this, you know, if we believe, which I agree with what you said, we should start seeing signs of that rolling together. We should already see it in my mind in progress. Like, then the question is, it's difficult to find, you know, that going on. At least it's not very apparent. You know, so in addition to what you said, I saw the video too, what else is going on? You know, because it's hard to find, you know, evidences of they're rolling together.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, that video was a surprise to me because I didn't realize, you know, that there was that networking that was going on. And networking is not something that you can necessarily see if it doesn't come out. There have been voices in the past, in recent past, that are against any type of cooperation. Jimmy Swaggart, for many years, would talk down the Catholic Church. Have you heard very much of Jimmy Swaggart lately? No, his voice has gotten kind of scythe. He's probably still on, but it almost seems like somebody talked to him and said, cut it out. because he had not taken those positions that he took in the past. There is a movement that's been around for quite a while called the Christian Reconstructionist Movement. They're 20, 30 years old, and actually I think the head of the movement, who's deceased now, goes all the way back to the 50s and 60s. But they are a religious movement that feels very strongly that government and religion will come together. And they are a political movement, very active probably in many places, but in the South, Texas in particular. They are very political in that they go out to try to endorse candidates that believe, like in the Ten Commandments, you know, and church law and whatnot, and get them elected to judgeships, town councils, to mayors and whatnot. It's a real grassroots level. This has been going on for quite some time, rather quietly. I rather suspect, though, that just like I was surprised that the Pope would be addressing this evangelical association, that these things will kind of pop up and we'll be surprised at where they are. I may make one more comment, too, with the election of Donald Trump as President of the United States. He is despised by both the left and the right politically, i.e. he's despised by the establishment. He's not an establishment person. I mean, whether you like him or not, he is an earthquake in politics today, and he's shaking things up very much. But please note, he had the strong endorsement of religious groups, Christian groups around the country. Again, I would say this is another reflection of the populism movement that are just upset with the way things are, the status quo. And they'll elect even somebody like a President Trump in order to shake things up. And it's just what he's doing. So it'll be interesting to watch. Brother Jim, you have a question, please? Don't make it a long one. I got 5 minutes left.
Okay. In Revelation 18:4, it says, "And I heard a voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, receive not of her plagues," so on. Then he says in verse 6, "Reward her even as she rewarded you, double unto her, double according to her works, in the cup which she hath filled, fill to her double." Here it seems like the Lord is saying that the church is now having the upper hand in the situation. So I'm just wondering how that fits into your overall view of things.
Good question. I don't have an answer for that. On that particular verse, I haven't thought it through, so I would just be speculating. Clearly, remember what we said about John the Baptist, that I go on decreasing, but he goes on increasing. We're getting smaller on this side of the veil, but the church in power and authority is getting larger on the other side of the veil. We've often had very interesting discussions and speculations. You know, what's Jesus and the church doing now? Well, they must be very busy getting things done in the preparations and whatnot. And it may be that some of that preparation, some of that work, some of that exercise of power in the details of guiding events might be something along the lines of what your question is. But beyond that, don't have too much. I got 3 minutes. Anyone have another question, a quick question? Yes, brother. Oh, it's Brother Dan. Hello, Brother Dan.
When you spoke about 1 Kings, and you were talking about Zedekiah's point of view, so to speak, you were using that as a picture to show that the church would not be on this side the veil during the worst parts of Armageddon. Could you explain that further? I heard you say it, but I didn't catch what there in the picture drove you to that point of view.
All right. Was that the picture of Micaiah? You said
yes.
Zedekiah?
Yes.
I'm not sure that I would use that picture to demonstrate that point so much, Brother Dan. I would use the Daniel in front of Belshazzar because of the two symbols there, the scarlet robe and the chain of gold. He gives this just before Babylon falls, the night before Babylon falls. He's given these two symbols that I think show very clearly the death of the church and their glorification, and then Babylon falls. There's probably a couple of others, but just quick off the top of the head, I would use that rather than the Micaiah scripture. That was, in that case, he was imprisoned rather than killed, and I don't know that you could work into that. If I said something along those lines, then I probably misspoke. A clear indicator of the church's finishing their course before that. Good question. Brethren, thank you very much for your attention. And again, as I mentioned at the start, this could be...